Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. You might hate McMansions, but do you know why? Kate Wagner does, and in wanting to educate people about the oversized, cheaply made, and poorly designed beacons of suburbia, started a blog last year called McMansion Hell. On the blog, Kate translates architectural language into humorous criticism of McMansions using real estate photos, obscuring identifying details of the home's locations and residents. She also includes educational posts on the site and contributes to outlets like 99% Invisible and Curbed. McMansion Hell quickly gained a large following, but was thrust into the spotlight in June when real estate marketplace Zillow sent Kate a cease and desist letter for using its photos. It was determined that Kate's parody photos were fair use, and Zillow didn't pursue further legal action. We talked about using architecture to approximate power, house hunters, and how the residential is political. Here's our conversation. What is a McMansion?
Oh, man. Well, okay, so a McMansion is basically an oversized house. Usually, I mean, my quota is over 3,000 square feet, which is generous. And it is a house that is not particularly well-built or well-designed. Usually the materials are very shoddy. The layouts don't make any sense because they're basically like checklists. It's like, oh, I need to have a chef's kitchen and a master suite and a master bathroom with cathedral ceilings and all of these like selling points essentially that are designed on the inside and it's reflected on the outside. The sort of haphazard way things are sort of thrown together.
Is this a definition of a McMansion that you came up with, or is there like an architectural like McMansion definition out there?
These are my qualifiers when I look at houses to determine whether or not they're McMansions. There are certain architectural features that are a lot more damning than others, I think. This, for one, like the roof lines are pretty telling. If the roof line looks more like a mountain range than it does a roof, you're probably looking at a McMansion. Roof lines of different pitches and different heights, and generally just chaotic composition. And also the sort of material pastiche, where you'll have one side of a house, or you'll have one mass of a house coated in one material, covered in one material, and then the other will be another material. So like the mass that has the front entry will be stone, and the garage is vinyl siding or something like that, where every sort of the divisions that are already there are articulated through material selection. That's another really McMansion-y quality. And also usually there's like at least a 2 or 3 car garage, if not more. If you're looking at a house with a 4 car garage and it's just right there in front of you as a huge part of the house, it's not a good sign.
turn away.
So these are just some like of these qualities. I actually devised a scale a year ago, a McMansion scale from 1 to 10, and It's pretty useful.
Is that
actually
the McMansion Circles of Hell?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember when you first realized you hated McMansions?
Well, it's funny, like when I was a kid, I was in Girl Scouts actually, and the Girl Scout troop leader lived in a McMansion, and her family was miserable. She was going through like a nasty divorce. Her kids had, you know, issues. It was just generally an unhappy family, and it was reflected in this house where there's this huge house and there was nothing in it. In the backyard, you can see where they were painting the fence, and then when they got divorced, you could see exactly when that happened in the fence painting process, because everything after that point was just the fence was still not repainted. There was all of these, it's like you have all of this money, all of this space, and you're miserable. And it just, it kind of had a lasting impact on me. And also, the woods next to my house was torn down to build a McMansion. And I'm an amateur botanist, so that was pretty devastating when I was a kid. I was like in middle school when that happened. So I never really liked them. But for me, it's never been, oh, I hate these so much that I have to devote my entire life to hating them. It's more so that I think that they're interesting as an architectural phenomenon.
When did you get into architecture, and what kinds of things were you into as a kid?
Well, when I was a kid, well, I was always into architecture. I've always been an obsessive house watcher, driving by places, just nose to the window, kind of seeing what houses were where, what did they look like. Even I rode the bus when I was a little kid, and we were the first kids to get on the bus and the last kids to get off the bus. We were on the bus for like 2 or 3 hours every morning, and it was... I remember just being constantly obsessed with the houses that we passed and to see who came out of what kind of houses. And they were mostly just like residential suburban houses. Most of them were from the 70s and 80s. And then there were newer developments. And I was just curious to see how these things sort of change as we move from development to development. And also just unique things, unique architectural styles. For example, one of the houses that I passed on the way to school was an A-frame house that was just glorious. It was brand new. This just amazing A-frame house. You could see through from one side to the other, and there's a lake behind it. And these people had like kayaks and all of this cool stuff like on their porch. And that house was just so different from all of the other houses. It was just fascinating. And so when I started to get more serious about architecture, I started to ask myself what architecture did I like the most? And I kind of settled on sort of late modern architecture from the 60s through the 60s and 70s mostly, because I really think that that stuff looks completely different than anything else. Really, the sort of language of modernism was pushed to the extremes, and I personally find that really fascinating.
Did you like the house that you grew up in?
Yeah, it was a good house. It's not an interesting house. It's a suburban tract home. It's 1,500 or so square feet. With a garage, front facing garage. But there's no like architectural atrocities. It's just a house. It was really a normal suburban house.
How did you know that architecture was going to be a bigger part of your life beyond just peeking at all the houses out the bus window?
Well, I mean, for me, I always have a bunch of concurring interests. Architecture was one that lasted, you know, has lasted a very long time. And so when you start, you know, studying something when you're really young, you just develop like a vocabulary after years of like intense personal study. For me, I actually, when I was in high school, I wanted to be an architect. And my guidance counselor at high school said, "You're not good enough at math to be an architect. You should go do something else." So I went to school for music, and I've been a classical musician my whole life. I started playing the violin when I was 4 and went to school for music composition. And during that time, I started working as a recording engineer doing classical music, which requires, you know, large concert spaces, and trying to understand what made those rooms, you know, tick and the way that they worked, you know, sonically and otherwise, was something that I kind of wanted to study after I got done with my degree. I knew that I didn't want to get another music degree, and I really wanted to work in the architectural field, because I felt like I made a huge mistake not going to school for architecture, but it was like too late to transfer, and there wasn't an architecture major at my college, so I just said, well, I'll just, you know, stick it out. And so that's why I applied to the program at Peabody, because I knew that I would be able to do some kind of work with you know, architectural acoustics, and to work with architects and designers in making better sounding spaces. And before I came, I started the blog. It was the summer before I started grad school.
Why did you decide to start the blog?
Well, I just kind of felt like there's a bunch of like, haha, look at these real estate photo blogs. But usually the real estate photos are insane. The people who have like 80 stuffed mannequins in a living room, and it's like creepy. So, you know, we focus on that. I really think that there's like, yeah, people know that houses are ugly. People like hate McMansions, but they don't really necessarily know why that they hate them. And so I kind of wanted to start a blog that used McMansions to teach people about the foundations of architectural composition. All while being extremely snarky, which I don't think I can extract from any writing that I do, no matter how serious it is. But I think that it was a sort of a desire to do like an ugly house blog that, you know, was at least explained why the houses were ugly, rather than just being like, I hate that house. That's stupid.
And the humor makes it much more approachable, right? I mean, is it kind of like a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down type of situation?
Yeah, I think so. I've experimented with various different, you know, serious articles on the site, but they're always kind of like written in a way that's lighthearted enough that I kind of write the site for people like my mom, who, you know, that my mom loves houses, of course, and watches HGTV all the time, and but doesn't really know that much about, you know, what, you know, makes architecture tick, or about architecture in general. I mean, there's huge swaths of the population that consumes all these house shows, all of the like interior design, real estate kind of shows, and it's like there's already an interest in the built environment that we, you know, are surrounded by for most people in America that happens to be the suburbs. There's already like a general interest there that I think that could just be sort of sculpted into something more nuanced. And I don't believe that people are stupid, and I don't believe in talking down to people. I believe in explaining things in the way that makes me like them and that makes me sort of feel alive and interested in them, and trying to communicate that to others and like to be as genuine as possible, rather than actually in 1914 this house did this thing and it was an example of structural expressionism, and I just think that's really, it's just I can't stand that. I can't stand the sort of academic aspect of a lot of fields, whether it's acoustics, whether it's classical music, which I think is particularly, you know, a horrible example. Every like attempt made in classical music to bring it down to earth has just failed horribly, I think. But also in architecture too, because like architecture is like the big A architects doing their thing, and it's like an elite field that no one can really communicate with. But even though that like the built environment surrounds all of us, and I think that it should be something that should be more aware of. I mean, people care about these things, and it's just a matter of cultivating that care.
Why do you think architecture does seem so unapproachable to so many people?
Because architecture, a lot of it, the high profile architecture that we see in the news and in, you know, the New York Times style section and stuff, that's like elite architecture. People feel very disconnected from that. So a new art museum opens in Los Angeles. Somebody from the suburbs of South Carolina, are they really going to care? I mean, There's part of it that is that architecture is not necessarily, architects are not working on the ground in people's communities. They can't get as invested in architecture because it just seems so distant from their own lives. I think that because the focus of architecture for a really long time has been on large civic projects and not necessarily on, you know, smaller community or residential projects, I think that there is just a disconnection from most people towards the professional world of architecture. The professionally designed building is sort of not really welcome there, or it doesn't feel welcome there. It feels like an alien thing that stands on an island and you have to pay money to get in.
It kind of reminds me, I interviewed Ellen Lupton for this podcast, and she said one of her goals is to just make people know that the world has been designed. Like, you know, the coffee cup you're holding has been designed by someone, even if you just throw it away and it seems extremely simple. Would you say you're trying to do a similar thing with, like, even if it's just the suburbs and not a brand new museum in LA, to show people that things have been designed for better or for worse around them, and it's not just unintentional?
I think so. I think that's accurate. I think that it also comes down to getting people sort of more involved in the history of their own spaces. Because a lot of the spaces that we create in America are faceless, but at the same time, they're not necessarily faceless. They have an origin story. They have a theory. They have a practice. And I think that if people sort of knew more, I think people are always curious about the sort of places that they inhabit. People love all those videos about dead malls, and they love all those videos about the history of retail and all of these things, because it's something that they interact with on their everyday lot, with their everyday lives. I think that bringing people closer to the identity of their own architecture, whether it's in the suburbs or whether it's in the city, is sort of empowerment. And by educating people about design, when they go forth to build more in their own name in the real world, they'll be more critical. I think it's important to cultivate a sense of criticism in everyday people. I think that the architecture position at the New York Times is, you know, one guy, right? But everybody, when they drive through any place, like, oh, I hate that building. oh, I can't stand this. And it's like, but if you ask them why, you know, I just don't like it, or it's big, or it's ugly, or something like that. And I think empowering people to be critical of design is also empowering them to make better design choices in the future, because they'll see things through that critical eye and they'll have the vocabulary that gives them the power to judge. I think a lot of people hate McMansions, and the goal is to give them the vocabulary to articulate why they hate them.
I know that the kind of the basis of, you know, a lot of the critique around McMansions is that they violate basic architecture principles. So I guess I'm kind of curious about how they end up getting built, because presumably you hire an architect, right? And they build it, or is that not how it works? Like, how are all of these principles violated in practice?
Well, I think that it depends on the neighborhood. Of course, there are like these planned communities that were built before the recession that were extremely speculative, where a lot of the plans come from either like building companies, like, for example, like Toll Brothers or Ryan Homes, these multinational, multi-billion dollar corporations that are responsible for like building a lot of suburban dreck. But at the same time, there are other ways that these houses get built. For example, there are tons of collections of house plans on the internet that you can order and have a builder in your area custom built to scale. A lot of the times, like builders, local builders will have catalogs of houses that you'll flip through and sort of modify to your own sort of custom specification. And that's how a lot of houses have been built since the Industrial Revolution. I don't necessarily think that it's the process that's bad. I think that for a lot of people, like my parents' house was built that way. There was a builder and they had a catalog, and my parents looked through the catalog. They changed out some windows, and that was it. That was the house. It was built. That process on the sort of working and middle class scale is not the problem. I think that the big problem with McMansions comes from when you have the ultra custom home sort of experience, where really a lot of the design comes from the homeowners. And a lot of actually this ideology of building came during this huge speculative period in real estate before the Great Recession, where you had to have a certain list of features to sell a house, and people would just add these features and flip these houses for huge and huge amounts of money. And selling, so much of like the sort of fetishization of selling points is really what enabled the McMansion to rise in the first place. I think that the sort of ideology of a checklist that you have to have these things and they have to all be in this one vessel can only accrue such results of a certain amount of quality. Architects are equipped to solve some problems like this. Like if you handed an architect these features, I'm sure they would do something much different than what a builder does. But a builder is not the same as an architect. And while building firms may have architects, the builder's job is to build what the client wants. And I don't necessarily think that they should be faulted for doing their job to the best of their ability either. I think it's more of like a critique of our design language and how we communicate what we want in our homes. And I think that as people realize that these houses are big, and when your kids leave, they're empty, you know, you have to think about what works in the long run and what you really need versus what, you know, the media or pop culture or whatever says that you should have or should want. I often think of the home bar as an example, right? So like I see so many McMansions and they have in the basement, they have a home bar and a home movie theater. And it's so sad really, because you're trying to replicate a public space or like a commercial space or a space where other people live and dwell in the basement of your own home, because in the exurbs where you can afford to build these houses, you can afford the land to build them on, you're so isolated from everything that you might as well pretend to go to the bar in your own basement than drive 30 minutes to do it in real life. I mean, you have to sort of look at the sort of absurdity of American life and the absurdity of the isolation that comes from being so far from any sort of cultural or even commercial center.
The checklist thing is very real. I was watching House Hunters the other day. Yeah, there was literally a checklist and it was driving me crazy, because I want to say they were in like Iowa or something. And one of the people on the show refused any house that didn't have a bidet in it. And like, it was just, yeah.
It's like people don't realize, it's like they're making these like, the thing about House Hunters is that they've already bought the house before.
Yeah.
Like it's entirely staged. So they have to come up with these like justifications why they can't buy this house. And so they're often just really absurd, because they have to do that, because the thing is entirely staged. They're not making these decisions in real time. But the funniest thing about House Hunters is that because of that, it's the kind of changes that they want to make are like, there's like, I have to have a bidet. Well, how much does a bidet cost to put in, really?
Exactly. Everyone is like obsessed with this kind of, you know, turnkey instant gratification. You know, the house doesn't have the perfect knob on the cabinets, so I'm not going to buy it. That always baffles me, but anyways, yeah, I like, guess that's a tangent.
Yeah, I mean, it's true though. It's like, for me, I mean, I live in a factory, and here are my demands for my next apartment, and these are demands that have not been met since I left my parents' house after I graduated from high school. I want central air or central heat, one or the other. I don't care which, but one or the other. And I want a washing machine. That's it. Those are my two demands.
Humble demands. Yeah. You're gonna pass on the bidet this time, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Bidets are kind of cool, but at the same time, I think most Americans are baffled by them.
Yes. Well, how do you think we got to this point of checklists, and was it like that before reality TV?
What it really comes down to is it's the sort of hyper commodification of housing and of real estate that happened sort of at the beginning of the neoliberal era. When for example, with the coming of the adjustable rate mortgage, with the limitation on what kinds of loans that people could be offered was raised, when also things like the creation of the secondary mortgage market, so that like mortgages were being bought and sold instead of just being, you know, a pretty reasonable investment, right? They suddenly became like these commodities to be bought and sold and traded in tranches and credit default swaps and all of these things that contributed to the financial crisis in 2008. When you hyper-commodify something, really the checklist thing does make sense. It's like, does it satisfy this, and this quality? Because these things are now translating to like a dollar amount. So when people like had their homes, when they designed their homes, it's like, yeah, having a sunken bathtub is something that's nice and that's a luxury and that's why we want it. But really the mentality changed from like, you know, the late 70s up through now, that having the sunken tub is not because it would be nice to have, but because like if you want to sell the house later, then you can get a lot more money for it because you have like this. It was like about creating this sort of abstract value in what is essentially a depreciating asset. The house does, forget about the house. The land is what if you're sitting on a valuable piece of land or a land that becomes valuable, then the price will go up on your house. If you have like, you know, a reasonably nice house on like a reasonably like normal piece of land in the suburbs, it's not going to be the same than if you're sitting in a reasonably nice house in the city and the area is gentrifying and somebody wants that land that your house is on. It's the demand is not necessarily met by the bathtub sort of hypothesis. But at the same time, like during this speculative home building boom, that did translate to a sort of dollar amount. If you could, and it didn't cost builders really anything to put these features in. A bathtub, like a bath is a bathtub. Really, it was more about just satisfying these kinds of demands that translated to like a real dollar amount. It was a very the sale and buying of real estate at a certain point became so transactional. I mean, you just hear, you even when you like read these stories from like 2005 or whatever, it's like, we bought this, and we paid like they put like $1,000 down payment on with like a super subprime loan. And we have to have this, and it's like, we're doing this because we're just going to flip it or something like that. People just like thought their houses were just worth so much more than they possibly ever could really be worth because that was the way that things were. I mean, that was just when you hyper-commodify something, it loses its human attachment, really. It becomes a product that you use rather than a place that you live. And that mentality is really executed through the McMansion as an aesthetic force.
I would imagine it probably becomes kind of a self-perpetuating cycle too, right? It's like when everything has to be checklisted for the value, then, you know, maybe doesn't meet one of the check marks, and then the next homeowner puts that in, and they probably get even more kind of like hyper-specified, right?
Yeah, I think it's funny that, well, a lot of people just like will flip their house like every 10 years now. Well, they'll just buy all new furniture, put in all new fixtures, do all this stuff. I mean, my parents are in the middle of doing that right now. But to be fair, like their house is aged and it's time to just do that anyways. But I think that, yeah, it just becomes this exercise in spending and buying rather than living. I mean, college kids have furniture picked up from off the street, and they seem to be perfectly happy You know, I just think that like people are always so consumed with the buying and selling of things that they kind of forget the place aspect of it, that it is a place. It is a place where you want to create, you know, some sort of like communal essence that, you know, keeps your family together. And I feel like that's the other sad thing about the McMansion is that when everyone has their own room and their own living room, the whole house becomes so atomized that you'll go like whole days without, you know, seeing like one of your kids when they're a teenager. like when I was my friend or my Girl Scout troop leader's house, her, like, they were wealthy, and so they were some of the, her daughter was like one of the first kids at school to have a cell phone, and she would just text her mother from like upstairs before, like, this was before cell phones became like, you know, so it was, and that's why they have all these intercoms, like, that's the funniest, bonus feature that I think is hilarious is that they have intercoms in these houses and now everyone has cell phones. So
yeah,
like, what's the point?
Or I always think that about the like installed docks for the old iPods. I've seen some of those too wall, and it's like outdated 8 months later.
Oh, that's the worst. I mean, the thing is that even from like a product design standpoint, like having a dock is a stupid idea because like you make like an entire system obsolete for one part of it because one part of it is obsolete. That's the stuff that like I'm just like, why? But at the same time, you know, I think that there is a certain like there is a bonus to living in a small space. I think people become well adjusted and able to deal with conflict because they had to deal with like their sister like throwing a temper tantrum like two rooms over growing up, right? You couldn't escape from like the problems of family life. And so you had to deal with it. You had to adapt and you had to become like a social animal that can follow like the sort of rules of getting along. And I think that if you grow up in a place that is so isolated where you have no sense of community, where you have no sense of community within your own household, I mean, I think it just, it, for one, I think breeds resentment amongst a lot of children. And I think for another thing, it's just, I think it's a little cruel, to be honest. When you have to, when your kids' friends live 15 minutes away, it's like a 30-minute trip to go see your friends and you have to get in the car, get out of the car, fill the car up with gas, do all this stuff. I mean, what kind of life is that, really?
The blog's icon photo is Ronald Reagan photoshopped in front of a McMansion. And I was curious about, to you, what is the intersection of politics and design?
Oh, man. Well, everything, the residential is political. That is the truth. As far as like Reagan goes, that was just kind of a joke because, I mean, of course, Reagan was instrumental in the sort of this sort of commodification process, this sort of deregulation that bred the financial crisis to begin with. But it wasn't just him. If I could have Reagan and Bill Clinton and Michael Bloomberg and all of these people sitting at a table playing poker in front of a McMansion, I would probably think that would work out better. But honestly, when I first started the blog and it first went viral, people used to send me all these like hate mails about like, why is it Ronald Reagan? I was like, oh, I'm never changing this now. Like, it's
badge of honor now.
He's the smiling dad of McMansion lore, you know. And people email me like, actually, Ronald Reagan had a nice house. I'm like, yep, that's true. He did have a nice house, and they bulldozed it down to build a McMansion. So we're back to square one. I mean, these things are political. I mean, I try not to get as political in my blog because it's, you know, my political views are not exactly common. Personally, I'm a socialist, and so I look at things from a very sort of critical perspective. But at the same time, these things are political. There is the fact of the matter is that the suburbs in mid-century were subsidized. It was basically federal programs for housing for white people to move out of the city was what it was. Concurrently, there were supposed to be, so like the federal housing authority was supposed to be doing three things concurrently: urban renewal, which meant slum clearance, public housing. They were supposed to create like thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of units of public housing, and finance loans for people to move into the suburbs. But that backfired in that, so you cleared all of the slums, and then you paid people to move out of the city, and then you had public housing. So when the people in the slums had to go somewhere, so they went to the public housing. The people, there's a huge mass of people and capital flight out to the suburbs, so now there was suddenly just like a huge loss of jobs in the city. And so when people can't get jobs, they can't really pay their rent, and since they tied tenant maintenance to rent in public housing in places like St. Louis, the buildings didn't get maintained, and so we have these like horror stories of like Pruitt-Igoe and all the buildings get knocked down and all of this dramatic stuff. But it's a systemic thing that people don't realize what kind of impact like infrastructural policy has on the growth and the outlook of cities and other places. I mean, the Highway Act demolished swaths and swaths and swaths of city. And it was only until like Robert Moses came up with the Lower Manhattan Expressway, where he's going to destroy like almost all of Lower Manhattan to build this highway, that people are like, oh my God, we need to stop. Like, we're destroying our entire city for what? So cars can travel places, and they're just going to get backed up, and it's just going to be awful no matter what. It comes, you have to have there's a certain point where like there's a certain advancement that is made that's not necessarily beneficial. And I think that so for example, like today, we continue to subsidize a certain type of housing. We continue to give huge tax breaks to people who have like vacation homes, second homes, and homes over certain square footages, all of these things. We're basically giving tax cuts to rich people for their houses and their housing situations. Meanwhile, like people in the city of Baltimore are staging a tent city. So like people who have been waiting for housing forever and are basically homeless can maybe get some kind of transitional and leading to permanent housing. The kind of disparity in where money is spent in housing is a little bit disgusting. I mean, you have like you're starting to see these horrible tragedies of people, poor and working class people who live in places like Grenfell Tower in Britain, where to save £2,000, they put non-flameproof cladding on the outside and the whole building burned to the ground and 80 people died. Or like in Oakland, when all those people who were living in a warehouse died from that fire. I mean, when I live in a place that's like that, that was, you know, rehab for artists so we could all have cheap rent and live on top of each other. And if something were to happen there, I don't know how much better it would be.
And we've seen, you know, similar things in Baltimore art spaces, not similar in the fire, but artists being, you know, kicked out of the Bell Foundry and so forth.
And the Bell Foundry was unsafe. Like, that part is true. But they didn't even provide any sort of transitional housing. They basically knocked on those people's door to say, like, you're out, get out. And that's wrong. I mean, the thing is that there's no really such thing as an illegal tenant. There's only such thing as an illegal lease. Basically, with the Bell Foundry, they said, like, oh, if you live here, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And, I mean, honestly, like, I've been to the Bell Foundry, being someone who's on the art scene in, like, the basement, and it's like, that was a disaster waiting to happen. And people should not have been living there. But at the same time, where could they go? You know, there has to be some sort of, like, sympathy for people who have trouble finding housing. I mean, I've been apartment hunting myself for 6 months trying to move to someplace nicer or better. And the sort of for moving in the city, you have to come up with all this stupid money. You have to come up with the money to apply for the apartment. You have to come up for the money for the security deposit, which is an entire month's rent. Plus, you have to pay the last month of your rent in your current building. So you're paying 2 months' rent. And so you're paying three times the month's rent. You're paying for the first month's rent, the security deposit for the new place, and your rent for the old place. Like, no, it takes forever to be able to save that kind of money. And it's just been unfeasible to have, like, expenses and to have to do things and to have to go places. So it's so hard to, like, improve your living conditions, even if you, like, have a better lot in life than you did when you first came to the city. It's just, I mean, it's absurd. Everything is sort of stacked against people who are trying to make a better life for themselves and to live in decent housing.
On the political note, I also think McMansions convey so much about class, right? Even, they're probably one of the best examples of something you can, you know, a physical thing you could point to that conveys class in America. Because from the true wealthy perspective, they are very gaudy, nouveau riche, not actually classy. But then the whole point of them is essentially to convey wealth in the first place. I was hoping you could tell me more about that.
It's really interesting. I mean, I think that, yeah, the design language of McMansions is to convey wealth, and they borrow architectural symbolism from places of power. So, like, the double entryway, right, is like it's a metaphor for either a bank or some kind of other building, like the entryway to a skyscraper or any other place where there's, like, large windows, like a chandelier and tile floors. I mean, you're borrowing that from commercial and government architecture. You're borrowing these things as symbols of power. And I think it is kind of like a reflection of like people who are nouveau riche or in the managerial classes, or are they're usually like people who are, you know, in white collar jobs, not necessarily like rich people and not necessarily like upper middle class, like real, I would say like upper middle class, not quite the 5%, but definitely the 20%. And I think that, yeah, you want to convey this idea of wealth. You want to convey that you've, you know, made it in the world through like a material object. And that's definitely true. And that's why they're so tall, too. It's a matter of intimidation. To build things out of scale is an architectural effect. These things have been documented in architectural theory since a long time, since Edmund Burke, for example, who said, you know, that one of the reasons, like the sort of power of like the sublime is the massiveness of it. So you say, he cites, for example, the ocean or like the Alps, but it's on a smaller scale. To be dwarfed by your own house is an architectural effect. And essentially, this sort of intersection of the private and public spheres in McMansions, where I have to have a chef's kitchen or like a movie theater or any of these other sort of bonus spaces, is I can afford to have a whole town to play king in. There is like these sort of like metaphors of power. There are these metaphors of power. I think it's a symbol of powerlessness. It's like you've not quite made it, right? But you want to convey these things through all of these gaudy appearances and whatnot, and like real rich people will laugh at you. But real rich people really aren't that better off, because rappers and football players also have McMansions. They just cost a lot more. But I think that ultimately, I mean, yeah, like this is also just a part of like this sort of material symbolism of class that was so popular in the 2000s, for example. Like I'll share like a personal story here. When I was in middle school, girls set my hair on fire for not wearing Abercrombie and Fitch. It's like there was this status quo going out right before the recession of you have to have this, 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 and this to convey that you were worth something in America. And it was a matter of like a brand name recognition or a certain like style of house via MTV Cribs. But I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Lauren Greenfield, who is a photographer. She did that documentary about the woman who built the replica of Versailles.
Yes, I have seen that. Queen of Versailles.
Yeah. That, which is absurd. But she's been documenting wealth in America for like a very long time. And she has these pictures of like poor families like combing through racks at Goodwill to try to find clothes with brand names on them so that like their kids like won't get bullied at school. And like, I mean, I remember doing that when I was like a kid, because it's like I couldn't afford to go to Hollister and buy like the Hollister brand stuff. My parents couldn't afford that. So you just always try to find it secondhand wherever you could. And if they found out that you bought it secondhand, they would also get punished for being poor. And we weren't poor. We were just like working class people who like didn't make like $100,000 a year or whatever and couldn't afford stupid things like $30 polo shirts. But at the same time, like in the sort of design language of wealth in America at that time, you were poor if you didn't have those things. It was really just like this black and white perspective as an adolescent, at least, that it was like the haves and the have nots. And if you're in the have nots, like life is going to be a lot worse for you. And I think it really does prepare you for sort of the reality of the world and the sort of like economic system. I think that these things are true, that like there is this sort of imagery of wealth that people try to co-opt, because it's easier to sort of convey those things through images and through status symbols than it is through like a sort of understanding of economics in this country.
I would imagine that for people who aren't a fan of your blog, one of the criticisms they could make would be, you know, why is it any of your business? I like my house. I built it how I want it. You know, you're being an elitist. How would you respond to that criticism?
I think that's always hilarious when people call me an elitist. I'm like, yes, me challenging the architectural taste of the elite is an elitist. Like, just think about that for a second before you like open your mouth. It's like someone who's here to take down like basically the BS that fake rich people have. It's like, so that's how is that being an elitist? You know, it's, you know, I just think that honestly, also part of my goal is to get people who aren't rich invested in the field of architecture, which has always been a rich person's field. Those of us who can't afford to hire architects or can't afford to be in this sort of sphere of attention that the elites happen to be in, whether it's actually, ironically, McMansions fall into this and I'm giving them attention. So, I mean, I recognize that sort of contradiction. But I think that, there is some the study of like the housing of average people, right, of like working and middle class people, it's considered sort of like in an anthropological lens rather than in an architectural lens. And that's something that's starting to change over the years with the sort of like renewed interest in like sort of you know, American history or pop culture at an academic level. But at the same time, like most, there's not a lot of documentation on the houses that most people live in. And the sort of new series that I'm trying to do right now is bringing attention to the way of, so people can identify things about their own houses and about like, you know, the houses, like the house that I grew up in, which is just, you know, a suburban tract home. But there is like a still a story there. There's a story of development. There's a story of design. There's a story of like architectural co-opting from different aesthetics. There's a story of like consistency within floor plans, which are more consistent than architectural style over time. I mean, there's all of these things that could be explained, and it's the goal is to show people that, yeah, your house is special. It's not just like these jerks over here who have like the big foyer who are special. All of our houses are special. All the little row houses, all of the little apartment buildings. It's like that's a home. That's where people live. It's not a status symbol. The people who can't afford to buy all of the like ridiculous furniture or do all the ridiculous things confront the reality that their places are places to live. Their places to sleep, their places to eat, their places to raise their kids. It's not about like an object that you convey in some sort of semi-public lens. Like the sort of public perception of your property or your asset or whatever is not as important to them as is like, can I heat and cool it? Like, I'm curious about like where it came from. Like, here's all my pictures of my kids. You know, it's just not the same. For these people, the house is a private thing. It's a private life, and it doesn't exist to convey certain images or perceptions to other people.
What reactions do you get the most from the blog?
Oh, they're mostly positive. Actually, I actually don't get that much hate mail. And when I do, it's usually about Ronald Reagan. whenever, like, I don't read the Facebook comments in any article where, like, something interviews me. It's like, I hate that girl and her stupid hair, and I hate, like, that she's like, doesn't she understand that these are people's homes and this is what, and like, blah, blah, blah. It's like, here's the thing. Houses don't have feelings. They're inanimate objects. And rich people, their feelings are not worth considering because they're rich and they can do whatever they want.
And you're never, on the blog at least, you never cite people.
No.
It's the house. Yeah.
No, it's, I make up, like, I obscure, I fudge details about, like, the houses. Like, I only go, like, what the county that the house is in. In this case, this is in Las Vegas, which is not a county, but it's massive. So we all know it's Las Vegas. But it's about what sort of like the county. It's like fudging the numbers, like the number of square footage, like the, you know, these things. So people can't just like, you know, I don't want anyone to like get, you know, bullied online or anything because of this. So whenever there's like personal photographs in the real estate photos, I blur them out because it's just a polite thing to do. I mean, I'm making fun of the object, which is to say the house, and as a part of like a cultural critique about like the perceptions of wealth in America, or like a generational critique of like the sort of old ideas of what it meant to make it in the world, and this millennial critique of like, I can't afford my student loans, but like here you are with a gold-plated toilet, you know, these kinds of like very much, you know, material kind of critiques or cultural critiques. I'm not here to be like, look at Abby C. from Wisconsin and her ugly toilet. Look at her face. I hate her. That's not like this is about. It's about the objects. It's not about the people. Like, I could care less about the people who like live in or buy McMansions.
Why do you think people do think that, you know, they would be offended by critiquing their McMansion? What is it, if these designs are very isolated and not personal, you know, I guess, like, what is there to be offended by? Are people offended when other people think they have bad taste? Or what do you think about that?
I think it's a certain guilt of their own wastelessness, honestly, or their wastefulness. I think that that's really what it is. I think that they know that this is like a waste, and then they know that they're not really rich and they're just pretending to be rich. And when someone calls you out on that and your image is called into question, which is not polite to do in polite society, yeah, that can be really personal. But at the same time, like, those people have money and they have power in this world. Like, the people that, like, so, like, yeah, we should laugh at them, you know. They don't have to suffer for anything. So some girl, like, makes fun of your house on her blog, right? Is that really, like, the worst thing? Like, if that's the worst thing that's going to happen to you, if that's really what's going to, like, get you in a tizzy, like, man, you must have a nice life.
I read that you were working on a book proposal. Is that true?
Well, I was working on a book proposal. Right now I'm trying to finish school. It's like there's some sort of like professional developments that I think about, right? It's like, when are you going to write a book? And the truth is I don't have the time to write a book. I'm writing my thesis this year. So I'm going to be writing a book, but it's not going to be it's going to be about concert halls. It's not going to be about McMansions, and I'm going to get graded on it. And
yeah, what's your thesis?
Well, my thesis is about 20th century concert halls, like a sort of like a taxonomy of different concert hall styles and a sort of examination of different spheres of relation within concert hall design from that period. But I plan to focus, I think, on concert halls from 1960 to 1990. The sort of transitional period in concert hall design from like high modernity to postmodernity.
Do you see yourself doing more with McMansion Hell?
Yeah, well, I make a living doing McMansion Hell. So, well, it's funny, like, I always just thought, when I first started, it's like, yeah, this will wear off at like any second and people are going to get so bored and hate this. But the longer I do it, it seems like that's just not the case. It's sort of like become kind of like a webcomic format. Like, you know, webcomics, you're right, from, you know, that, like, they generate content like on a regular basis, and they have backlogs of years and years and years, and people are still interested and they can still stay afloat and people still like make a living on them. And I think it's really starting to take that format and become, I mean, I've had to learn a lot to keep up with this project. It's really been like a lot of research and time and resources have been devoted to better understanding the phenomenon as a whole and to writing like really sophisticated cultural critiques outside of like the sort of pop media realm. But I think that as long as there are houses, I think that the demand will continue. Whether or not I don't know. I don't plan on quitting McMansion Hell anytime soon because honestly, I find it to be very enjoyable to do. I like to hear, you know, people's stories about architecture. I never get a chance to respond to like all the email that I get, but I always enjoy like reading people's like responses. They're like, oh, I always knew I hated this, and now I know why. And it's like, you should see this house on my block. Oh my God, it's horrible, and it's usually horrible. And or like when I do like these more informative posts, they're like, wow, I never knew that was like what that was. I remember this building that I grew up next to that was built in the 60s, and it was like this. And it's like those are cool stories to hear because you realize that yeah, people are connecting the dots. They are recognizing like these things and learning about like the built environment and getting more invested in the world around them, which I think it leads to like enrichment and a better life, honestly, because you'll never run out of architecture to look at. You know, that's just the truth. And when you're in places where you can run out of architecture to look at, it's usually awesome, like a national park, or like you're just on a road and there's just nothing, which is an awesome in and of itself. Like, again, going back to sort of the idea of the sublime. And it's like when you aren't like submersed in sublimity of nature or like the human condition, you can take a drive through any suburb and be like, oh my God.
Kate, wait, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Kate Wagner. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. You can find Female Trouble everywhere you listen to podcasts and at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble. We're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble. And our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's own TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back with a new episode next week.